Wonderful. So I will start by saying this is Rosemary Hall, recording for the Dialect and Heritage Project at the University of Leeds. It's Wednesday the 19th of October 2022, and could I ask you please to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Andrew Ellis, and my father was Stanley Ellis, who worked at Leeds University, which we're going to be discussing.
Yes. What was it like to be son of Stanley Ellis?
All right. The strange thing, if the most overall, was that he featured on the radio and the television very regularly, and that was just at the time when I was at junior school, and to me that was normal. So last night, Dad was on the radio. And, you know, your friends at school looked at you a little sideways, you know, if, oh yeah. So that was odd. And but it was just normal in our house because Dad would be talking about, yeah, I've got to go and do this recording or what. But that was part of how the household was. There was always a lot of chat about words and playing with words. A lot of the stories that we had from Dad and Mum's time in the caravan, and how they had recollections of places and phrases that people had used, which they would bring up in the course of day-to-day conversation, which would keep us on our toes and remind us of these pet phrases that they would have. One I remember particularly is, I think if I quote it correctly, is Thranger's Throp's wife wit dishclart. So that was one of the phrases that comes immediately to mind. And they would, as I say, recollect places that they'd stayed, which they were amused by. One place was called Killam Crossing, which is a strange place to drive through, when that's the name of the the village. And I remember we had impoverished university junior lecturer at that time when I was little, so it was minivans and put windows in the back to try and reduce purchase tax and things like that, because it was trying to keep the family going. But we'd all be thrown in the back, and we would go and visit farmers and friends that they'd made over the years when they were travelling from place to place in the caravan. And these people had become lifelong friends, and we became friends with their children, and so it was multi-generational, was the relationships with which we had with the normally farmers. And then I remember there was a couple of archaeologists in Lincolnshire. We would go and visit them, a lady called Mrs. Rudkin and her partner. She was quite a forceful character, and she'd got a very old house in the middle of a village, which the whole village was owned by an estate, and all the gates were painted exactly the same colour. Mrs. Rudkin's house was owned by her, in amongst all of this whole village that was owned by the Lord, as it were. Her house was full of artifacts that she had excavated from different places. A lot of vases and clay pots and things would be all over the place, and interesting things. So Dad's had a lot of interest in with dialect history. He'd obviously had interest in the area history, because that matched and linked in with the research that he was doing, and the stories that he'd heard from people would be about the area. So He got involved often with local museums, Yorkshire folk life, things like that. And so we were dragged along to these places. And then it kind of, only as you get older, you realise it kind of joins into the jigsaw. So visiting these places was normal. Links with radio programmes, mentioning names of people that he knew, he'd met. And people came to our house. We often had visiting professors would come and stay with us from foreign countries. I remember when I was a little boy, a gentleman came from Russia and stayed with us, and he gave me gave me a little badge about the Sputnik, I remember, which I probably got somewhere. And Dad also used to do other types of work. He ran a summer school for foreign English teachers through the British Council, and he, I think there was something of the order of between 50 and 100 people would come from all over the world, and we would be invited to go and meet these people for meals or day trips out in coaches when he would take them to Haworth or the Lake District and show them Bronte birthplace, Nodding Daffodils, I can't remember the one in the Lake District, but yeah, Dove Cottage and things like that. So we'd be taken along as stooges to chat to them. So I would speak to people from Africa, European countries, behind the Iron Curtain. And then Dad also, I remember when I was little, he was one of, I think, when Romania was closed to entry, and there were only about six people a year going over there, he went over there and did some talks. He did a lecture tour in the Cameroon in Africa, travelling in a Land Rover from place to place, overland. These were just extra little jobs that he would do on the back of his normal university work. And I'm just looking at my notes here because he was... And then he went on to do the develop what he'd learned as a researcher into a forensic science. So that was again a side thing, but there was the spin-off. And I don't know how much our listeners will know about his biography, but he did do a piece on the very first piece of recorded evidence that went into a court of law, and it was a recording of a gentleman in, I think it was Boston, might have been born in Lincolnshire, and obviously Dad had done his he did a research piece on the dialects of Lincolnshire, but the gentleman had got drunk and had not quite certain whether he'd actually lit a fire, but he was a disgruntled employee of a local seed company, and he tried to call the fire brigade to go to the wrong place, perhaps that he was going to light a fire in another place in his drunken state, and he was foiled because he couldn't get his words right for where he was intending to direct the fire service. So a recording was made of this, and I found the tape in the drawer when I was older, and it was the tape that Dad had used to kind of cut around and play different sections of it to show that when they got the gentleman in as a witness, he then made a repeat phone call from the telephone box, and the interruptions from the services and the operator, as there had been in the original call, were mimicked. And so the contrast between the gentleman relaying it later and the original were then played against each other in court, and it was shown that the gentleman was indeed the original hoaxer, I want to say, you know, the original perpetrator of the false call to try and get the fire brigade out, and he was subsequently given a sentence. So, yeah, that was an interesting little piece of the way life was, and
that was the first forensic work that you've done.
That was the first forensic recorded piece of work that was submitted in a court in the UK.
And did you get the impression that he enjoyed that forensic work?
Well, he went on with that to do become involved, I believe, and I was just looking this online. I'm not sure whether he knew the gentleman from a college, his university days, or whether it was through Leeds University. A gentleman called Barrington Black was a high-level barrister in Leeds, and he's referenced as being involved in the Black Panther case. And I know Dad was also involved in that one. Whether that is the same as Leslie Whittle, I'm not sure. But he was involved in many of those kinds of horrific cases. He also spent quite a lot of time working in doing cases at the Old Bailey as a specialist witness. He...
Just pause for a sec.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. He worked in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. A lot of the cases over there, and he, we would have policemen would come to the house, and he would be taken to be talked to or pass opinions or whatever at all times of day and night, or dropping tapes off, that sort of thing would go on, yeah.
And by this time, had he left the university?
There was an overlap, definitely, because we subsequently, but I, as a cheeky little boy, I think I had half an idea. I remember him telling me when I was about 12 that he was going to have to go down to London probably at least one day a month to do some work down there. And obviously, by virtue of the fact that he didn't tell me what it was about, my inventive mind must have worked overtime, because we found out later that he was actually working for MI5 and MI6, setting up departments for them to be able to do voice analysis and locate people by virtue of their accent. So that was a huge piece of work, and both those organisations were represented at his funeral. Gentlemen from the services came on that day. So, yeah, it obviously made a big impression over those years when he did all that work for them. I think that was Stella Rimington was the head of MI5 at that time. So, yes, I think that does that answer your question.
When did he die?
I don't know. I'm sorry, I can't remember the date.
It's all right.
2009, I think. Yeah, I think that's about right. Yeah.
At what point do you think you became aware of the significance of his work?
As I say, there was this sort of disconnect in the fact that I would talk about, as I say, Professor this or so-and-so that, and my school colleagues would have no idea what I was talking about. I would talk about on the radio, and obviously they didn't say, yeah, my dad was last night as well, or that kind of thing. So you start to realise, and then you probably keep a little bit quieter once you've spouted off initially. But inside you're quite proud. Yeah, yeah.
And Were you always interested in what he was doing?
Oh, come on. I can't say I developed an interest for it, but wordplay certainly was something that we all did and joked around. A lot of long words we used in the household, odd words we used in the household. And again, I've got down mimicry. He was a very good mimic. And so he was mimicking things all the time. He would come home and he would say words as they would in this area of the country, or he would say something about that. And he would sometimes say a little bit of support, but probably, a bit of explanation. But we were just kids, you know, that was probably not quite picking up on it like the students that he had. He did have, in those days, looking back and realising, you know, with the advantage of now having my own degree, realised that he could select. And I remember him saying to me, well, we could just get AAA students all the time. So in those days, you got the top of the crop going to do English at Leeds. And they were in his tutor group, you know. And the local MP in Harrogate was in his tutor group. I met him. I'd seen him on the bus as a little boy, strangely enough. But when we grew up and I sort of bumped into him and I said, oh, blah, 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 Dad. And he said, oh, yeah, I was in his tutor group. And I remembered when Dad was young. He's a Conservative. I remember when Dad was young. When I was younger, Dad had said to me, Jack Straw was in my tutor group. So there's, you know, he was. When I say, you know, they were getting those AAA students coming in, they were then going on, inspired by the things that he'd said to them. I know that because that was the comment I got back when I spoke to this gentleman in Harrogate. He said, yeah, inspiring. And yeah, obviously, that was... And I think that's what he had. He had that... he certainly had a series of ways with people. Having done so much interrogation... The size of his questionnaires that he had to discuss with people were humongous. And to keep focused and concentrated over a 3 to 4 day period in order to get all of the answers that he needed and steer the conversation into a certain direction in order to get that example on the tapes that he was making was, from a mental point of view, it's just massive what he was achieving. And so, yeah, but you don't realise that when you're little. It's just a ferrograph tape recorder that, you know, and here's one for you to play in your room with, which I had, you know, that sort of thing.
Okay, tell me about that.
Well, he'd got these huge, obviously we're talking about recording equipment at the, at its birth, spool-to-spool tape recorders. And they had to be portable, and they had to be of a quality that would produce something that was worthwhile putting on a disc, ultimately, because that was what he did. So these very heavy, sort of 3 foot square and about a foot deep, huge, I believe he had a pair of them, but he also had some equipment which would allow him to get power from the Land Rover, because he had a 1953 Series 1 Land Rover, which wasn't the first vehicle, but I think that the university got him that to tow the caravan with. And he made bits so he could charge batteries up from the Land Rover and run the equipment. And then he got power in the field, because obviously these rural properties that he was visiting, they wouldn't have things like that. And the quality of batteries in those days, nothing like we have access to. So he would have to take this equipment around. And he had a colleague back in Leeds University, a chap called Reg Ross, who was quite a... You've got to imagine that there's the university on a level, and I think in those days it was in a row of houses. And down in the cellar would be Reg Ross, surrounded by wires and bits of all sorts of interesting gadgets and gizmos. And Dad would have to go and visit him to talk about changing voltages. And I think he also did a washing machine for my mum that could run on 12 volt or something, so that she'd got a little bit of help in the caravan. So he would visit Reg, and Reg would they'd go through all sorts of things. And Reg had a zither. I remember that when I was a little boy. It's a sort of square, multi-stringed lute kind of thing, and I was fascinated by that when I visited when I was a little boy. But that's a digression.
You said you had a recorder to play with.
Sorry?
You had a recorder yourself to play with.
I had one of those tape recorders, yes. And it was because I had this tape recorder that I'd found this tape that Dad had done of the of his analysis of the crime, that I'd just found it on the back of a tape that he'd used. He had hundreds and hundreds of tapes, of course, and he would perhaps need to access them. He'd got lots of equipment. They got lighter and lighter, did the tape recorders, as time went on. But those first ones must have been quite a nightmare to carry and lug around. So that was the early action in the caravan, yeah.
But the caravan was before your time, was it?
I was never in the caravan. I remember the caravan, and I mentioned those farmer friends. One of the farmer friends from Bedfordshire, the very caravan, when it stopped being towed around, was left in their farmyard. And so I did go and see it, obviously in a dilapidating state by then. But, I mean, what do you do with a huge, heavy caravan when you're finished with it after all that living and working in it?
And you mentioned before that he would tell you stories about life in the caravan. Can you remember any of those?
Yes, only that it was... They would, as I understand it, move every couple of weeks. And Mum would set up shop in the corner of a field. One of the tricks he did say was that you would go to the post office, and he would sort of pitch to the postmistress or the postmaster what he was looking for. They, knowing everybody, would be the ideal route to give him, you need to see old Jack at the end of the village. And we've got a caravan and we need to... I know. Home farm down here, second on the right, Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so, you go and see them. And so that technique that he started to build up was his method. He would go make friends with the farmer. My mum would do her bit with the farmer's wife. And obviously, great relationships came out of this type of thing. And then he'd go off to his subject and start the process of the questionnaire.
When he told you about this, was he animated? Do you get the impression that he enjoyed it?
Oh, yeah. I remember he did say to me, because he was telling me about, you know, finding a job when you're older, and he said, find something that you like doing, and then it's not a job. And that was exactly how he saw it. It was just fun. And so that infectious ease with which life went by, tried to adapt myself, which has been great. He did give us a good gift there. He did give us a good gift there. Yeah.
Yep.
So, but he was before he'd started the work, he'd been out in India. He did his national service in India, and he did say to me once. He said, "I was up for an assistant to. I think it was either Montgomery or real high up. He didn't get that job." But what he did get was he got running an airport in Delhi. He was in the RAF. And so he had a fantastic time out there. And he would tell us about, you know, how he'd explored, went in his leave and things like that. going up into Kashmir and up into the foothills in India, and meeting all sorts of interesting people. And he, I don't know whether this is an interesting one, but he did. he met a couple, and he always used to tell me this little story. He met a couple in the foothills, and a brother and sister, and they invited him to go for a picnic up into the hills. So young man on leave went off with them for a picnic, and they got found a clearing in the trees and set the picnic out. And they were sitting there, and they could see up the hill a man on a donkey coming down the hill. And the man came down the hill and threw into the clearing on the donkey, and it was a fellow scoutmaster of my dad's from Bradford. And so my dad used to tell this story about coincidences. And he said there was a little add-on to that, because when he'd come back to the UK many years later, he said to me, he said, I was walking through a hotel lobby and the lift opened, and out of the lift stepped the brother. That was so he would like little things like that. And he often, one of the things he used to do, I did notice, because as a son you do tend to notice this kind of thing, he would get a little project story, and whoever he met, that was his project story that he would tell them. You'd be yawning, but because you'd heard it. But that was his little, he would do that. And then next week he'd have a different one. And that was another way that he, so he'd got lots of these sort of structure techniques that he'd build up for his interviews and things to break the ice, intrigue people, draw them in. And at the end of the day though, you know, what, when you've got a subject that you're asking people to talk about themselves, that does make it easy, doesn't it? So that was some interesting things there.
Do you know much about his relationship with Harold Orton? Did you ever meet Orton?
No, I don't think. Well, if I did, I'd be very, very young. I know there was a wall that we used to drive past, and he and my mum referred to it as the Orton Memorial Wall. And this was where Harold had crashed his car into the wall. So it was kind of like we doffed our caps as we went past and waved at the Orton Memorial Wall. So beyond that, and it being a bit of fun, that was, no, I didn't. I know that he was, another of his predecessors at the university was the actual person who, the role that he had was Tolkien. And I know he knew Tolkien's wife and kids quite well. Though again, I don't think I met them. If I did, again, I'd be very young, and they would be just these people, you know.
And how about with his students? Did he talk to you much about his teaching?
Summer school, I saw lots of that, those kinds of students. I would go into the university occasionally, and meet some of his colleagues, but I don't think I ever met. Yes, there were times. There were times. Yeah, yeah.
Did he enjoy teaching?
Yeah. Oh, I think he did. Yeah, yeah. And I think he was on the Senate as well, for a while, because he would say things to me about blah 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 at the university, and sometimes. A story's just jumped into my mind. So I went into the university. It's not about the students there, but it's about Dad's preparation. So the circus was in town, just on the heath at just across from the university. There's an open bit of ground. I can't remember what it's called. Billy Smart's circus was there, and it was my birthday, and Dad said he'd take me to the circus. Now, in those days, the circus was a huge event, and the circus caravans filled the whole of that moor. I think they call it a moor, don't they? It was a huge area, and we went into the and we got some good seats, and we watched the show, and there were a huge row of, in those days, I think it was something like six or eight elephants all standing on each other's back across the by, you know, on the hind legs, just feet up on top of other ones. But we were right next to them, and this was a spectacular sight. And of course, as a young lad with humour in mind, I loved the clown. And I think there was a car that exploded, and oh yes, that was right. He got a change of outfit. He sort of pulled the front of his trousers down and then switched it over, and suddenly he was a Scotsman. And then he played the bagpipes. That was his kind of end point of this clown's show. And we then left the circus and wandered off through this massive area of caravans. And he took me to this caravan, and we went into the caravan, and there was the clown. And I spent 5-10 minutes having a chat with this guy, and it was lovely. Only later you work out Dad had obviously gone down in his lunch hour, found out where this chap was, slipped him a fiver or something, and set this up for his son. And it was a lovely little treat for me. But he would prepare things. He would prepare, and he had ways. He could have persuaded the clown, no problem, because he just got straight into people to talk, draw them out, get their interest, and he just drove the conversation. He had to, as we've said, to get these questions done. He was very, very skilled, very, very skilled at that. But again, those are the things you only realise as you become an adult. So, yeah, yeah.
How about later in life? Did he ever stop working?
He didn't really, no. Because, as I say, life was just, you know, whatever the game was, and he wanted to carry on doing those things. So the radio shows became a set of series of shows, and one was a town called something, or a town like, and there'd be a dialect expert, an architectural expert, I can't remember what the others were, 3 or 4 of them, and they basically were old buddies, and the producer was a friend, so they'd go and stay in a hotel somewhere, and they'd find the things around the town for each of their expertise, and they'd turn them into little interviews, sew it all together, and it became one of a series of radio programmes. So he was going off to do these, and it was something you could do in your retirement quite happily. You know, it's, what did you do? Oh, well, we went and stayed in the hotel and I chatted to people. Oh, yeah. So, yes, he got it sorted. And, he knew a lot of people at the BBC as well, because he was down there for a long time doing a lot of things. And I remember going into, he was on Look North one evening. If people remember Harry Gracian, he was a local presenter here, and I remember I went into the green room just before he went on the television show. It is like a 6 o'clock news item, and Dad's expertise was being talked about as an item on a magazine type evening programme, and I was able to sit in and watch through the double glazing to see what happened in the studio, and get a little flavour for what went on in a TV studio. So, yeah. So there was, yeah, he could do those things and pick up on all those different areas that he could include. I mentioned he's got a skill about mimicry, but he'd also got another skill which was phenomenal, and that was he had a full map of the UK in his head. So we would be going somewhere and a road would be blocked, and we'd turn off the road and we'd go down a road and we'd get to a T-junction in the middle of nowhere, and he'd say, "No, we turn right here and then there's a road on the left, and you cut through there and then we'll go down the dip." And he would steer us completely, because he'd spent several weeks in an area, he got to know the area, and then he'd go to another area, and as well as interviewing, he'd know about the routes and the roads around the area, because he'd have to get there and back from these remote farms where the interviewees were. And as I say, he had the full thing in his head, and he could just, yeah, go cross country from anywhere to anywhere, which was a weird thing when you think about it, because, yeah, you know, it was like, yeah, well, he knew exactly where he was, and he knew that junction. You know, it was interesting to see. Interesting to see. Yeah.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
How do you feel, sort of, from your perspective now, looking back at his career?
Thanks for being my dad, which is lovely. How do I... Well, it's sadly, it's often when somebody dies that people start to pass information to you. And we had such incredible... letters and contact from people who had known him, who he'd influenced, and they just started to come out of the woodwork, and it was and then of course you get an opportunity to go through people's papers, and Hillary, my sister, found the papers when Dad met MI5 and things, and the back and forth letters as he was just being introduced, Mr. White, Mr. Green, and then Dad gradually starting to take the mickey out of them because he knew these names were all false, which is lovely to see in the letters there, yeah. And we got a lovely letter from, what's the gentleman? He does a Thursday morning programme on the radio. An academic who just, what's he called?
Melvin Bragg?
Melvin, yeah. And Melvin just wrote to us, and just, when somebody like that writes, I don't know whether it was 4 or 5 full pages of glowing warmth of personal relationship, it was that's quite scary. Wonderful.
Is there anything else you'd like to share, any other memories we haven't talked about?
Wow, I'm just I've talked about his practicalness, easy manner. The other thing that he did was it's just something that it struck me as well, only as I got older, was he was so mentally healthy. When he travelled, he would dig out places to go, people to see, make the most of that place that he was visiting. And whether those were the skills that he'd learned in radio programmes or his travelling, he would certainly make much more out of it than me. He would find things. He liked music, he liked classical music, and he would find concerts, he would find art, really go to town on finding things and meeting with people. And that was spectacular. So I think I've probably covered. Oh, and he was also a local preacher. That was the other thing. Yeah. So we'd got a Methodist church in Ilkley where we grew up, and I think cost and everything, they decided to close the church and sell that bit off and then move into the hall, and he and a few others spent nights and all sorts of time and effort turning it into another church, but basically a modern one that didn't have all the costs and issues with the old building. So that was something that he had. And I visited where he was at college. He was at college in Cambridge before the war. And then the war, then he had to do his war service. And then when the war had finished, obviously, all of the people who'd gone to war wanted to go back to university. And so he didn't get a place back there. He went to Leeds and finished his studies off there. But I visited where he was at, I think it was, I've got it written down somewhere, Corpus Christi, I think. And I visited it and I just got that sense of thinking back to how Dad was at that time. He'd got religion, he's got a lot of books about the philosophy of all of that. And you can imagine just across the road from King's College with the huge, the bells that ring, the whole community that you would be part of. And I got a great sense of that camaraderie, because we did meet a lot of people that he'd met and known. They were still friends and we would go and visit them as well. A lot of visiting by the sound of it, but you know, people would come and see us as well, and there was always a great welcome, which obviously was part of it, you know, cups of tea in the caravan, and people had made contact. We had caravanners that they'd met would come and stay on our drive when we'd finally settle down in a house. So yeah, it was all lovely. Yeah, lovely.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for sparing your time. It's been a real privilege to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed.